crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nuchtigal. Welcome to Watch Jerusalem. If this is the first time that you've listened to the program, we come to you every single week, or almost every week, here from Jerusalem, Israel, and we like to cover biblical archaeology and also prophetically significant news out of the Middle East. Today, on today's program, we're going to focus on biblical archaeology, as well as a documentary that I had the chance to go and see last night. It was a early screening of this brand new documentary. I think it's the third or fourth one that Gloria Greenfield has done. I believe she's a Jewish director, but she does a lot of important documentaries on very important, pertinent topics. This one last night, her latest, was entitled The Fight of Our Lives, a new documentary which examines the threats facing the West. And this is, it was a very important documentary to watch, went for about an hour, just over an hour. Just because it basically looks at the Western civilization and its current demise, and the causes of that demise, the roots of that demise, and where we might go from here. It featured extremely prominent journalists, historians. Victor Davis Hanson's in it, Melanie Phillips, British journalist and also writer for the Jerusalem Post, she's in it. She was also there last night. I got the chance to speak to her for about 10 minutes before the program, catching up just a little bit, and then to talk about a couple of her books that are coming out shortly. But she was there to discuss also, adding on from the documentary, just the big threats that Western civilization faces and the big threats that Israel faces, because it is at the seat of Western civilization, just because that civilization is based upon, at its very core, the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish Bible. That is the foundation of the values and morals of Western civilization, and the battle for Western civilization right now gets back to, or at its very basic core, gets back to a battle against the Bible. Norms that have been just taken as norms throughout the centuries because they were based on truths or laws from the Bible, and as that is done away completely, so too goes Western civilization. I just want to play the trailer for you of this documentary, The Fight of Our Lives, at the beginning, just so you can get a clear picture of what exactly is discussed in this important film. Here it is, The Fight of Our Lives. And I might just add that it begins here with historian Niall Ferguson.
Civilizations, empires, great powers can fall apart very fast. Collapse can come suddenly like a thief in the night. And we should be very wary of assuming that our civilization, the civilization of the early 21st century West, will oblige us by declining gradually.
I think there are two threats facing the West, and they are linked. There's the threat from within and the threat from without. And the threat from without is made much more threatening by the threat from within.
The kind of light fog of fascism that seems to be descending on many universities poses a tremendous danger for the future of Western values, because it threatens to miseducate the future leaders who have to promote the values we cherish.
In order to get rid of a bad idea, you have to have the proliferation of good ideas and let them battle it out in the marketplace of ideas. What political correctness does is it declares war on the marketplace of ideas. And it says, you can't talk about that. That's offensive.
We have various studies programs that are out there, which are designed not to teach students how to think, but to teach students what to think.
We're going to go back through history, and we're going to pick winners and losers according to our own particular passing value system. And now that passing value system is race, class, and gender. And maybe it won't be tomorrow or the next day, but we're going to rename things. We're going to Trotskyize art. We're going to do whatever it takes to make sure that all the people in the past fit our idea of a ethical race, class, and gender person.
There's a tendency in the mainstream media in particular to downplay the threat, to give off the impression that it's just a criminal action. Yes, there was a terrorist attack, but this is not part of a larger theme or a larger movement. It's just some lone, isolated wacko carrying out attack on his or her own.
Muslims who are Islamists, who believe that society should be governed under Islamic law, that is Sharia, are not tolerant of the religions of others or the lack of religion.
Even though we in the West want to say, look, it's not a holy war, this is not a Christian, Jewish, Muslim conflict, many, many, many Muslims, even though they're a minority of the Muslim world, I mean, these are millions of people, see the world and the future in exactly those terms.
It's not about left or right. It's about all of us. It's about the future of our children and grandchildren. It's about the future of the globe. I think that the key to the question of Western civilization is the preservation of moral confidence. Does one have it? Do you feel it? Can you articulate it? Can you explain why what this civilization has created and become is so precious that it should be maintained?
That was the trailer for the documentary, The Fight of Our Lives, by Gloria Greenfield. Again, that was screened last night at the Menachem Begin Center here in Jerusalem. And after that, or just before that, actually, Ms. Greenfield, she got up and gave a few comments that I thought were rather stirring. She talked about her motivation for doing this film. She's done a number of these type of films, mainly focusing on anti-Semitism or the state of Israel. This one more broadly looked at Western civilization and its current state of demise, unless something drastic changes course. And in her comments, she went back to the very beginning of Western civilization values, and she said that the Hebrew Bible, or that the Bible is the very foundation of Western civilization. She said, destroy the Bible and you destroy the foundation of Western civilization. And this is something that we have been able to watch very closely on this program, and also just for a number of years in the field of archaeology, as the Bible has become come under unprecedented attack, at least in terms of whether it is accurate or not, whether it's accurate in the things that it discusses, whether it's accurate in the history that it discusses. And she was saying, this lady that made this documentary, that if you do away with that text, then the foundation for Western civilization crumbles as well. And you don't have anything to base your civilization on as far as what is socially acceptable, as far as what laws should be. Moral relativism has taken over, and Melanie Phillips in her speech after the film discussed that quite a lot, and how dangerous that is, how that it's the feelings of the individual trumps fact these days, and how that you can't say that one civilization's value system is better than another civilization's value system. We're all equal. And that's where the Bible does set itself apart when it comes out and it says, well, this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is evil. That isn't a popular message today. And yet those laws, which have governed our society for so long, They are the foundation of Western civilization. It comes right out of the Bible. Now, it was interesting in her comments towards the end. She did say that though she has presented a bleak picture, she is excited, and she's excited for that there might be some change on the horizon. And she gave 2 points for why she's excited. One, the election of Donald Trump, which showed that there were many people in the United States, at least half, that decided enough is enough, enough what we're being fed from the media, enough of what we're being fed by many politicians, by the elites of society, by the academics of society. Enough is enough. We do like the values of our country. We are proud of our history. She's excited about that. She was also excited about Brexit, where enough of the Brits decided that enough is enough. Once again, we want to determine our own laws inside our own country and stop being dictated to by a foreign entity. And she looked at those things, and she does look at those things as a source of hope. And yet towards the end, or at the end, when they opened up for questions, there was one man that stood up and asked, looking at those two things, Brexit and the election of Donald Trump, and was asking, is that enough? Is that enough to turn the tide of Western civilization back? 8 years, 4 or 8 years of Mr. Trump and Brexit coming out of the European Union. Is that enough to turn the tide? Is that enough to swing the pendulum back in favor of a defense of Western civilization? How do we change the academics? How do we change most of the politicians? How do we change the elites in society who are still pushing their anti-Western civilization or anti-Bible at its very core, at its very root, bias? That's what they're still pushing. Is the election of Donald Trump and Brexit enough? And Melanie Phillips and even Ms. Greenfield as well tried to answer that question. And or how can we get those people to change? And the answers weren't very convincing. Weren't very convincing at all. But at the core as well, it looks like Melanie Phillips might be right. There might be a little bit of respite against, or a little bit of pushback right now, against those nation-destroying values that were put in place, or that have been put in place and been pushed by the elites in society because of the election of Donald Trump in the United States and because of Brexit, and I would say, and because of Prime Minister Netanyahu in this country. Now, if you are one of these people that don't believe that we are witnessing right now a stunning collapse of Western civilization because of the values that are being pushed by academia and the media today, then I would advise you just watch this documentary, The Fight of Our Lives. I'll leave a link for it in the show notes of the program. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be looking at the Bible's place in archaeology and what actually happens if you choose to use it and uphold it in your practice. We'll be right back.
This is Watch Jerusalem on KPCG.FM. Thank you for listening. The relatively new science of archaeology, the digging up and study of the material remains of man's past, has confirmed without question the historical accuracy of the Bible. Solid, documented evidence, apart from the Bible, confirms events and persons that at one time were known to us only from Scripture. The Bible is real, and you need to pay attention to it. Call now and request your free copy of The Authority of the Bible. This lesson, which comes from the Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course, blows the dust off your Bible. You will learn how to mine the treasures buried in the greatest book on earth. You can discover its secrets and enrich your life today. For more information, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. We're going to talk about in the second half here the value of using the Bible in archaeology, particularly looking at Dr. Ilan Mazar. This is a lady we talk a lot about on this program just because of our close relationship with her. We do excavate with her. We excavated even today at the Ophel here in Jerusalem, just below the southern wall of the Temple Mount. We're coming to the conclusion of the excavation there. I think we've got two more weeks of this current phase. There's a lot left to do, it seems, but there's a lot of exciting discoveries that are starting to be made towards the end of the season. It's when you begin to really understand the layers that you've uncovered, the discoveries in their appropriate context as well. And so just in this past couple of weeks, we've gotten down to the very bottom of our cistern, the big cave that we've been excavating in, excavated through some really interesting layers relating to history of Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. And Dr. Mazar has just been blown away by the fact that here we are in the center of town, really, as far as ancient Jerusalem goes, ground zero of ancient Jerusalem, the royal quarter, and we have this massive, massive cave, or massive cistern, rather large cave, that was used as a cistern throughout multiple periods, going back to the First Temple period, then, as we're finding out, used all the way through the Hasmonean period, the years from around 175 all the way through to the time of Herod the Great. This cistern, this cave, was in use, holding water or functioning in some capacity for water. We've found numerous layers, vessels, coins from that very important period in Jewish history. And even above that, we found, as we've talked about briefly on this program, just some really important layers relating to the final siege of Jerusalem by the Romans in 70 AD, and even the years leading up to that. What's interesting on the coins that we discover on the excavation here, obviously the Jews revolted against the Romans beginning in 65-66 CE, and then because they did that, the Roman Empire sent legions down from the north and the south, mainly the north, and gradually conquered this territory of Judea, and then finally encircled Jerusalem and besieged it. And so you had the Jews that were minting their own coins through this period. At the first year of the revolt and the second year of the revolt, they minted coins. And on those coins, we have the inscription, Freedom of Zion, written on there. Freedom of Zion, written on there. And then once you get to year four, which was the year that they kind of stopped minting. There are some year five coins, I believe a silver coin for year five of the revolt, which would be 70 AD, and they were found at Masada, which was the last holdout of the Jews after Jerusalem fell. But inside Jerusalem itself, what we only find there, the very latest coins we find there, year four of the revolt, 69 AD, and we found so many of those in our cave. And what they decided to write on those anciently was Redemption of Zion. Redemption of Zion. They knew at that point that they were going to fall to the Romans, and we are just finding evidence of that, the imminency of that destruction, impending destruction. And the efforts that they went to, the Jews, to try and hide from the Romans inside these type of caves and caverns, and even doing a tunneling, as Josephus even says and talks about during this period. And so it's really exciting to be in that cave, to find those layers, and even knowing that this cistern was used even back into the First Temple period. And then just a week ago, we found another entirely different cavern that we didn't even know existed, or we weren't sure existed, between bedrock and the top of our cave. And that's got numerous shafts going into it as well. I've had the opportunity to excavate inside there right now, just in the Byzantine period inside that. And so we are just finding more and more surprises, and Dr. Mazar is always surprised by what we find every single season. And as we were talking about it the other day, it's nothing is just normal on these excavations. There's always surprises on our excavations. This was the second time that we've found a random shaft that we didn't know existed. Back in the City of David, we found a massive tunnel behind the stepstone structure. If you've been to the City of David, the Palace of David, the stepstone structure is this massive retaining wall that the palace sits on. It's the eastern wall the palace sits on. And we were excavating at the very base of that. And then we found a massive long tunnel. It's about 40 meters long. It's collapsed on both ends. Nevertheless, I mean, here we were not even expecting to find something like that, just going through the layers on the side of the stepstone structure, and bam, we're in a tunnel. And while archaeologists will claim that all the time that if you watch Indiana Jones, that's not archaeology, From my experience, Indiana Jones is pretty close, actually. Indiana Jones is pretty close to what can happen on excavations. Thankfully, we're not being attacked by the Germans or the Russians or anything like that. But nevertheless, we are always surprised, and there's always an air of anticipation for the next discovery. And we feel that even on this excavation with just 2 weeks left to go. But I just want to talk about Dr. Ilhat Mazar a little bit and the use of the Bible and how she uses the Bible. She's bashed a lot by some of her colleagues and by those in the, many of those in the left-leaning media, because she uses the Bible in her archaeology to help her decide if she's excavating on the Ophel or in the City of David. She looks at the geographic markers of the events that took place in the Bible and says whether this could be where that event took place. It seems logical to do that, to look at a historical source, the best historical source we have of that period, and excavate in Jerusalem and try and see if you can match up what you find with what's written there. That makes sense. But I don't want to talk about necessarily her designation of the Palace of David, or maybe even Solomon's Palace that we're in perchance right now, or even Nehemiah's Wall, because they can be up for interpretation. I want to talk briefly about what happens when you use the Bible in Jerusalem. What are the side benefits? What are the things that happen to your archaeology which reveals startling discoveries? Now, there have been archaeologists that excavate all through Jerusalem. There's many archaeologists that are excavating right now in the City of David, in the Old City, just outside the City of David. There's three or four digs currently going on within a mile radius of where we dig. And yet you do hear some of those discoveries of those excavations, but nothing as far as in terms of what Dr. Ilhat Mazar has discovered. If you're even just talking about inscriptions, ancient inscriptions from the Bible of personalities, there have been four that have been found in Jerusalem in the past 100 years, seal impressions of first and last names, or first or names of people from the Bible that we can say 100% from the Bible. They were found in archaeological excavations. And just in terms of how much excavation takes place, I might even leave a map for you of a picture of a Bible atlas that talks about gives you a map of the City of David and all the excavations that have taken place there in the past 100 years. And it's the whole hill, much of the hill has been excavated. And yet, only four seal impressions or bullae with biblical figures have been located in those excavations. And you know what? With all the names of excavators down through the last 100 years, three of the four have been found in excavations by Ilhat Mazar. And that's stunning. That's stunning considering how much of the whole hill has been dug up. And it could be a testament to the fact that she is so willing to use the Bible. And if you do believe in God, she doesn't necessarily believe in God. And yet I believe in God, and I believe that God is very happy with her excavations, because she comes at it with the basis or from the standpoint that the Bible is innocent until proven guilty, not the other way around. And yet she has discovered seal impressions of biblical figures. These are beyond contestation. Why haven't they been found in other excavations? Yes, Yigal Shiloh excavated in the 1980s. He excavated in the stepstone structure there in the Bulla House, where he discovered 51 bullae, 51 seal impressions, these little bits of clay that originally sealed, in his case, documents. Perhaps this was some type of storage room for official documents of the government from the time, from the First Temple period, from the time of the Bible. And when it burnt down, all those clay seal impressions got hard, extremely hard, and they were in the destruction layer at the very bottom of that. And he discovered a 50 or 51 of those with his eyes, or the excavators did at least, there at the bottom of the stepstone structure. And only one of those, beyond contestation, beyond doubt, mentions the person name in the Bible. Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, mentioned, I believe, in Jeremiah chapter 36. He is the man that, or it was in his chamber that in Jeremiah chapter 36, it talks about how in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, this is the first time that Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, is coming upon Judah, 19 years before it would go into captivity completely. And what's happening there in Jeremiah chapter 36 is Jeremiah is told by God to write down everything, or to get somebody to write down everything, all the visions, all the prophecy that God has given him, all the warnings that God has given him from that point, from the years of Josiah up until the time of Jehoiakim, and write them down and put them in a book. And so he does that with a scribe named Baruch. And there in the Bulla house, there is a Bulla that says something very close to Baruch, the son of Neriah, which was the scribe of Jeremiah. That's possible that there was his scribe, but it's not complete, or it's broken off, so we don't know for sure. But at that time, you see Jeremiah being shut up and unable to deliver this message. And so he tells Baruch that I want you to go and deliver this message to in the palace court there. And Baruch wasn't too happy about that. He was a scribe. He was a fairly lofty scribe. He was well known in the royal court. His brother actually worked for King Jehoiakim and as the quartermaster, and so, or the chief steward. So he was likely somebody that had a future as a scribe. And Jeremiah here said, God wants you to go and deliver this message. And that's where you can put in Jeremiah chapter 45, where Baruch is quite upset about this, when God has to severely correct him, not necessarily severely, but he does talk to him and say, Baruch, this whole country is about to be plucked up. I'm bringing the Babylonians, I'm bringing Nebuchadnezzar, and here you are worrying about things for yourself, worrying about your future. It's time for you to go deliver that message. And so you can just slot in Jeremiah chapter 45 midway through Jeremiah chapter 36. And so he does go and answer the correction and follow the correction, receive the correction and change his course. And he goes and delivers this message. And where does he do it first? He does it first in the chambers of Gemariah, the son of Shaphan. And after that, the people that are there listening, they're so excited about it. They take the scroll and they give it to Jehoiakim himself. Jehoiakim throws it in the fire, and God instructs Jeremiah to write it out again, to get Baruch to write it out again, and add a few bits about Jehoiakim and what would be his fate that wasn't in the first installment. But that man, Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, has been discovered. His seal impression right now sits in the Israeli Museum. And that is the only other first and last name of a biblical figure that has been found in controlled scientific investigation, archaeological digs here in Jerusalem. That's the only one that has been found outside Elot Mazar's excavations. That one, the 80s. Yigal Shiloh, the city of David. Dr. Elot Mazar worked on those digs. Ambassador College worked on those digs as well. And we have a biblical figure confirmed, without a doubt. And so that's one of the three, one of the four or five. Now I've got to. We'll go through them. The other ones, we had to wait. We had to wait for another 20 years before the next one was discovered. Even though excavation continued in the city of David, 20 years later, Dr. Elot Mazar goes back to the city of David. She gets funding to dig what she believes the palace of David, and what does she find? She finds Jeucal, the Bulla of Jeucal, and he's mentioned in Jeremiah chapter 38 and verse 1. The eyes of Yoav, one of the area supervisors, who has a very special knack for discovering these things, coins and such. He's a numismatics expert. He found it in the distance. He walked over and picked up a bulla from the ground, and here it was, Jeucal, from Jeremiah chapter 38 and verse 1. That's the first one that she found. A few years later, just on the other side of the palace walls, we were excavating in our Area G, just above Yigal Shiloh's Area G, and what do we find there? We find another person from Jeremiah chapter 38 and verse 1, princes that were coming to Zedekiah saying, put Jeremiah in prison, or kill him, in fact. Kill him. Zedekiah says, I'm not going to kill him. I'll just lock him up for the time being and throws him in a dungeon. Two out of the four antagonists in that story that went to King Zedekiah have been discovered. First and last name. First and last name. Jehiel and Gedaliah. Gedaliah, the son of Shaphan, found right there. And Jehiel's bully, you've got three generations that are actually mentioned on that one. So that's two and three out of the three so far that we've covered of first and last names of biblical figures proven by archaeological excavations in Jerusalem. Then we had to wait all the way from 2008 till 2015. 2015 is when Dr. Elot Mazar, again, her. Why her? Why not anybody else that's been excavating in the city of David since? Why not the current excavations? Why not? Yes, they do find important things. I'm not knocking their excavations at all. I know a number of the archaeologists, good archaeologists, that are working these other sites, but they don't find these biblical personalities. They don't. They don't find them. There in 2009, 2010, I believe it was about an 8-week dig there on the Ophel, the return to the Ophel after excavating it in 86 and 94. Dr. Elot Mazar comes back for a short season, finishes up some work. She digs down in an area previously dug by Kathleen Kenyon, previously dug by her and her grandfather in 1986, and finally gets to a clean layer. She excavates it, it goes off to wet sifting. She finds numerous bullae in one specific patch. And then a few years later, they come to look at those bullae, and what do they find? King Hezekiah. King Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. This isn't fake. This is real. I know the layer it came from. I was there, right there as it was came out of the ground. It's real. Nobody in the world, no archaeologists, even archaeologists hate the Bible. They know it's real. They know it's real. Found in the right context. And a king of Judah, King Hezekiah, of all people, second to David, as the Bible says, as far as kings go, he was discovered. And then in a patch just a few feet away, about 10 feet away, a patch that I got to excavate, unknowingly that it had so many rich finds in it, or so many bullae in there, I didn't actually see them with my eyes. Me and one other student at the time from Herbert W. Armstrong College, Harley Breath, got to excavate in this tiny little patch left over from Kathleen Kenyon, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago. And we excavated that dirt. It goes to wet sifting, comes back, and we have the seal impression of Isaiah. So Hezekiah, Isaiah the prophet, Gedaliah, Jehiel, four out of the five, in all the excavations that have taken place and continue to take place in the city of David, four out of the five seals that confirm the existence, first and last name, or first and first name and title in terms of Isaiah. Those seal impressions, four out of five, have been found in Elot Mazar's excavations. Why is that? Why is that? This isn't her saying, I found this, saying I found this, saying I found King David's palace or Nehemiah's wall, or giving a title to a structure. This is just what comes out of the dirt. There's no interpretation here. The Isaiah, you could say there's some interpretation, but it checks out. The other three, there's no interpretation. You can just read it. If you can read ancient Hebrew, you read it, and then you read your Bible, you look at the context, and it all checks out. That is the person from the Bible. Again, there have been five now. Five seal impressions of big biblical personalities that have been discovered in Jerusalem in the past 100 years. One was found back in the 80s, and then the other four have been found since 2008 in the excavations of Dr. Elot Mazar. Why is that? I just want to quote from you an article by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory. It's entitled The World's Most Important Archaeological Dig, and I'll leave a link to this article for you if you'd like to read it. And I'm going to go just to the very end of this article, because it looks at this question. It looks at this question of why Dr. Ilhan Mazar is so lucky. Why it's so why there's so many surprises? Why things are so unusual on her excavations? Is there something more to it? Yes, she is digging in Jerusalem, and so she does find important things. But there have been so many others that have excavated in Jerusalem. And while, yes, they do find important things, they haven't been able to discover personalities from the Bible. They haven't. This is what this article says here. Many archaeologists use the lack of physical evidence from David's time and Nehemiah's time to justify their lack of faith in the Bible. These discoveries should put those doubts to rest if the scholars would only accept the truth. Nehemiah's wall, King David's palace, Solomon's wall, biblical seals and inscriptions, these items have already been found and the digging continues. This was written back in 2012. The digging has continued and we have another two bullet. The prospect is high of even greater finds to come. Would you say the buller of King Hezekiah is a greater find? I would. The buller of Isaiah the prophet? Most definitely. Then he writes this. Again, this is Mr. Gerald Fleury. This is the most exciting archaeological project in the world to be involved in. It sure is. I believe what Dr. Mazar is doing will ultimately cause an earthquake in the world of archaeology. Then he writes this, truly the work of Ilhan Mazar has been blessed in a special way. Has it? Just look at the stats, look at the facts. Has her work been blessed in a special way? Has she found, as far as the Bible goes, I would say it is. Even if you take out her interpretation of or designation of David's palace, look at the actual things that turn up in her digs, the finds. And they are special, very special. She has been blessed in a very special way. Then he asks this question, is it because she operates on the premise that what the Bible says is actually true? Is that the reason why? Of course, those finds were there. They were in the dirt. They don't necessarily care who discovers them or whether they believe the Bible's true or not. They're going to be there in the ground. And yet, they haven't been discovered by other people. They've been discovered by an archaeologist who believes in biblical accuracy. He continues here, she is truly a rare individual who combines scientific method with a biblical foundation. Just as we were talking about before, the very foundation for Western civilization. Use the Bible and your society will go well. Follow the laws in the Bible. Your society will function well. Use the Bible in archaeology and maybe you'll be blessed in a special way. Then he concludes with this sentence. As she continues to use that formula, we can expect more astounding discoveries to come out of Jerusalem. Again, 2012. And what has happened since then? We've uncovered more of those biblical personalities. She's uncovered more of those biblical personalities. A king and a prophet. That's all we have time for today. Thanks very much for listening to the program. If you'd like to send us some feedback, you can go ahead and do that by sending your emails to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. I'll hopefully get to them and respond to them. Thanks again for joining us. You've been listening to Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.